welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today I have a fabulous guest. It's been one of my favorite things I like to watch. Wrestling. His documentary, The Flying Greek, is about someone you were guaranteed never heard of. The director and big wrestling fan, Jason Brazier, who's in the house. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I guess we got to start the thing. How did you find this guy? Like, it's not really addressed in the documentary. I was going to, like, did you just stumble on him?
Kind of. I worked on an award-winning talk show here in Springfield, Missouri, called The Mystery Hour. And one episode, he was on. And I had never heard of him. And basically, they ended up showing these pictures. And the most famous picture is of Andre the Giant holding him up on his shoulder. And that just struck me because I'd seen that photo before. And I said, oh my God, that's that guy. And I had been wanting to do a documentary for a while because I did one when I was in college, when I was still like a student. It was like, I considered it a student film that I did on my own. And I've been wanting to get back into documentary and wanted to find the perfect subject. And it just kind of happened right there. And I finished another project up first, and then I contacted him, and we sat down at the European Cafe here in Springfield, and I mean, it was like two or three hours, and he was just telling me all these stories, you know, about Randy Savage, he was Terry Funk, Dino Bravo. I mean, he was just telling me all of these. I mean, I was a kid in the candy store, and I just said, I've got to make a documentary about you. Yeah, Macho Man, yeah. He wrestled Macho Man and beat him. Well, I think he was still, I don't know if, I think he was under the name, his little mask persona early on, because he was still doing baseball, so he couldn't show his face at that time. But, yeah, he wrestled him quite a few times, and it just kind of happened. And from that point on, it just became this journey, and it became a longer journey than I expected. But I wanted to take my time because mainly it was trying to find footage of him wrestling, and all of the archives and my detective work led back to WWE buying out these archives where he possibly had footage. And, we reached out to WWE quite a few times, even with a lawyer, just trying to be professional. And we just got nothing, replies, no replies or anything. And, so I just got creative and did what I call dream match sequences, where I had like a black backdrop and the smoke and one light. And then I had him kind of wrestling out of focus here and there with one of the other guys and kind of like a distant memory. And oddly enough and cool enough, he still had all his wrestling gear and it still fit him after all these years. And that was really cool to be able to see him lacing up his boots and stuff and get some shots of that. But my favorite sequence in the whole film, though, is he wanted to take me in the ring and show me his moves and what he did. And I let that guy beat my ass for like a day, and I enjoyed every single moment of it. It was so much fun. And he was showing me the ropes, and it was great. Making of a documentary is just such a different experience than a regular film, in the sense that you really get to know these people a lot more intimately, and you kind of really become family.
Okay, you gave me a lot there, but let's pack it up and break it down just a bit more.
Yeah.
Now, tell me more how you started working on the Mystery Hour and a little bit more about that.
The Mystery Hour. I got into that because I was doing a lot of work for a group called Hype Media here in Springfield, and I would get hired into work the ESPN games, either here for Missouri State University, my alma mater, as a director, in-house director, or I would run camera. Well, they were the ones doing the Mystery Hour, and they needed an extra camera person, and so they asked me about it, and so I ended up doing 3 or 4 seasons of it. That's how I kind of got into it.
What was your first feeling when you walked into Benoli Jewelers? Like, how does that feel? Like, you're finally there. You're about to walk in, and you realize this guy has been there. Been there the whole time, and you never knew.
That's something. I love history, and no matter what type of history it is, wrestling or whatever, if I haven't heard about it, I want to know about it. And so when I walked into his place the first time, I knew there was a lot more to his story because, okay, he owns a jewelry store. So there's something in his life that connects to this jewelry stuff. And I remember him showing me how he did things that first day. And he even had a picture of his first time that he was making jewelry back in Greece in Rhodes when he was a kid and how he was learning and just seeing that journey. Now it's just like, man, this story is going to be really kind of in depth and layered. And I was so excited about it because it, you know, just walking in, it just feels like this man is just good at what he does now. And as I learned more, he was amazing at what he did back then. And, his work ethic, you know, he even talks about, you know, he had the same attitude he did in wrestling. You know, he was a small guy, took on the big, bigger wrestlers and got bigger pops than some of them, which that some of them didn't like, which is really funny stories. But, you know, he's the same thing with his jewelry business. He says he takes on the big guys because he's independent, you know, and, you know, he's always kind of been the underdog, and that's kind of what makes that his story really inspiring.
Now, in the doc, obviously, you do interviews in the jewelry store. Did you record some stuff about that and just drop it? Because it seems to be very wrestling-focused. I understand he does make jewelry. You talk about it briefly. But mm-hmm. did you film more stuff or want to go deeper in that? You felt it didn't suit your doc?
You know, that's the interesting thing about doing a documentary is I was trying very hard and felt that it could have easily been over an hour long movie. Absolutely. But as I was going through it and I was at the hour long, it's like after 45 minutes in the watching the film and that cut, it was like, it felt to me like I was forcing stuff in and that I could get his story within 45 minutes. And that anything beyond that was just going to be so, I was afraid I would lose audience at that point. And I didn't want people to do that with his story. And I tried to find a good balance because the wrestling does drive the story, but I was really trying to tell his story of more of the trials and tribulations of, you know, when he becomes a family man, how much more difficult it became, and trying to make the story where it comes full circle because he starts learning about jewelry, then he goes into boxing and he goes into wrestling. And then the one thing he falls back on in the end is jewelry and, you know, becoming a jeweler. And that's what helped him. So it was very much a choice of, am I forcing stuff in? And I felt like I was, and I have a rule of three. If I know something and I don't say about anything about it, and two other people out of three say something, then that's kind of my sign to me that I need to just probably change that, you know, especially if I didn't say it out loud and that two other people said it. Usually if one person saying it, I feel like you can get away with a few things sometimes, but when two people say it, you know, usually that's a big sign of, okay, I need to just, you know, modify this a little bit and go with what I was thinking anyway. And that said though, I have started a audio documentary podcast about the Flying Greek. I haven't released any new episodes just yet because I'm waiting to do a few more screenings before I do, but I'm releasing the raw audio of me interviewing Manoli about certain things, Bill Apter, and especially Constantina, his daughter. There was a lot more to her story that was great. It just, you know, I had to find that balance in the storytelling, and I'm going to be releasing more of those in the coming months so people can have a more in-depth understanding of that. But it'll be an audio documentary. And when I say audio documentary, it's me interviewing, but I'm also adding in sound effects and music to kind of, you know, help tell the story a little more of the unused footage.
When you interviewed Constantina, she seemed very passionate and very giving to you. Now, I found when you interviewed his family, they seemed a little more reserved, except for the one child that seemed to love it. Did you find the same thing?
No, not really. I mean, they're a lovely bunch, and I felt like when I interview people, I don't try to make it feel like an interview. I try to make it more about them talking And I think that a couple of them just weren't used to being in front of the camera. And so they were kind of more reserved about certain things. And which is fine, that happens. But I really wanted to make sure I at least got everybody in at least once for the whole family, you know, so the whole family was featured. And Constantina, I just felt like with her story, she just had a lot. Her journey was a lot more, you know, she had a different journey. And so I think that's why she had a lot more to talk about. And I tried to really make sure I placed her in the film at unique spots. So it's like, if you forgot about her and you came back, it kind of helped bring you back into it a little bit. And, you know, tried to, you know, like I said, the story behind it is wrestling, you know, wrestling does kind of push the story, but I really tried to make it more about family as best I could, you know, going through it, and tried to make the wrestling kind of not a secondary thing, but kind of on the same level.
I definitely say you forced it as a secondary thing. I definitely felt you pushed the family angle. Is that why you didn't want the wrestling to stand out? You didn't look for people that had matches with him?
Well, a lot of the people he had matches with don't like talking to him.
Oh, okay.
Well, I say that because the thing that I learned early on in the conversations with him in his interviews was the stuff that we see like the wrestlers doing nowadays, you know, as common. He was doing that stuff before it was kind of a big deal. Because, I mean, there was pictures we used in the documentary. I mean, that guy, his drop kick was so, like, straight. And he was just get up so high off the ground. And when you see Manoli and how tall he is, and then you kind of reference those pictures, you're like, you had ups, man. I mean, he could fly. That's what they called him that. He was the fly. That's how he got that nickname, the Flying Greek. And he would get bigger pops than people like Harley Race. And there's a story. Manoli didn't really, he goes, yeah, Harley didn't like me that much because of that, you know, because he would get like, you know, I mean, there was one story he told about, he was getting beat up in the ring by, you know, the heel, and, a fan got in the ring with a knife and was going to stab the bad guy. Well, the bad guy decided, saw it last second and dropped down, and Manoli got stabbed right in the arm here, upper arm, because the guy, believed that his favorite hero was getting beat up by the bad guy, and you can't have that, you know, and wrestling was a different beast back then, obviously, but there's just a unique thing about that, because I have wanted to find some people. It was just that a lot of these people were so far out of the way early on in the process that I wasn't sure how long we were going to be filming and different things like that. And I think I only have one person talk to me that got back to me. Because I even reached out to Lanny Poffo to see, because Mike, you know, Manoli had talked about him, and I never heard anything. He was good friends with Bob Backlund, and I reached out to Bob Backlund a few times and just never heard anything. So at that point, you know, after you don't hear from a few people, I just kind of decided to just, you know, make the best with what I could do, and I just really tried to focus on his story and all these different things. Now, that said, of course, we had the premiere, you know, back in December, and Constantina got a hold of me, and she goes, hey, I've got a video that I want to send you that somebody just sent me. I said, okay. And she goes, you'll want to use it at the premiere. Said, all right, who is it? And she sent me a video of Ricky Morton from the Rock and Roll Express. And Ricky Morton talks about Mike Pappas and how Mike Pappas had influence on him. And I was like, well, that would have been great to have like a 7 or 8 months ago, you know, because I would have included it. I do plan on using that as adding like a special feature on the DVD and stuff later on, and having those types of things that people send in. Because, of course, I knew after we got done filming, I said, I guarantee, or guarantee you, after we start releasing this, somebody's going to come up and be like, oh, hey, here's some footage of him that, you know, that I looked for almost 2 or 3 years. And if I do come across that, I just told Manoli, I said, if we get permission, I'll just put it on the DVD. So there's a special feature of one of your matches. You know what I mean? And so it just becomes more of an experience, you know, kind of a cool experience of your story. And then they can get a match and some other things that people were saying. So.
How long do you spend doing research before you start a project?
Oh, well, this one was actually kind of easier because one of the guys that we interviewed, Ray Malure, he was probably the biggest Mike Pappas fan ever. And he's a former detective. And the first day he came to film his interview and talk, he brought me a booklet that he had put together. And I actually have that booklet here still, but he had gone through meticulously and broke down all of his televised matches, who he versed, if he won, what titles title history, match history. He had already done half the work for me before I even started. So that really helped, helped a lot, because otherwise it probably would take a lot longer just because you have to go through the match history alone. Because I mean, he worked in the territory days, you know, with NWA, and you know, there were certain territories he didn't work in, and it just would have took a lot longer, which I would have happily done because I like learning that stuff and digging into it. But that definitely helped, you know, having a former police detective already done the detective work for you. And so I always, you know, especially on a documentary, you want to make sure that you do your research, because you got to find, my approach to it is always, I call it a journalistic approach. I want to kind of know where my story's going, and I kind of have a story. I kind of story outline it, like, okay, this is what we were going to do. And I break it down into acts usually. And then after I get that figured out where my story flow is going, then I get my questions based on that story flow. But I also know that it's a documentary, and that anything could happen in this whole process, and that we could go a completely different direction. But that's the beauty of documentary, you go with it. But at least we have kind of a direction that we're kind of wanting to go with the story, knowing that it could be modified, but at least we have a direction to go. You know, the original way of doing documentaries is you just kind of went and filmed, edited, then went back and filmed again until you got something done. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a very valid way of doing it. But I, you know, I'm very structured. And so I wanted to have a, you know, try to structure his story, because it was kind of, you know, I mean, we're talking about stuff that happened in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't want somebody coming back and say, well, that didn't happen. It happened like this, you know, and stuff. So I really wanted to make sure that we had some story down as pat as possible before we even started filming the interviews and so on. And I filmed him in his interview a couple of times, two or three times, because the more I noticed that we interviewed him, the more he started remembering certain stories, because he would be like, oh, I forgot about this. I want to talk about this. And so we interviewed him quite a few, you know, two or three times, just to kind of let him flesh out some more stuff that he was remembering.
Okay, when did you start wrestling? I mean, there's footage in the thing of you being a little kid. So did your parents allow you to hit? I mean, obviously, you can pretend you guys get it. It's not real in the sense taking a chair shot.
Oh, man. That's how I got into directing. I knew early on about wrestling. I figured it out. Some people always got mad about it when they would kind of figure out that it was this kind of performance art. And I respected it. I kind of was like, that's really kind of cool. It's kind of a live action choreographed stunt show is how I always started thinking of it. And I started seeing these photos behind the scenes from like WrestleMania back in the day with Vince in the ring talking with the guys. And I'm like, he's directing them and kind of working through the match with them. And I'm like, that's kind of cool. I wanted to be a film director at one point. I always wanted to be. I thought about it. And so my friends and I, you know, kind of got this whole wrestling thing, you know, what people would call backyard wrestling, although we never jumped off the freaking top of a roof and like light tubes and crap like that. I think the worst thing I ever did was I put somebody through a coffee table. That's because they went off script. And we had choreographed all day, and a girl showed up that he liked. And as soon as we rang our dingy little bell, he started fighting and tried to fight me because he was trying to impress her. And I ended that way. But we kind of got into the choreography of it. And of all things, what's really funny about this footage was how this happened. I'll never understand for the life of me. When I was going to church around that time as a kid, our youth pastor was like, well, we need to do some events to get more people to come to our youth group. And I said, hey, let's do wrestling. Jokingly saying it. He goes, okay. And I was like, really? So here's my opportunity to, like, put on a wrestling event. And we did it in this barn. And we would get there during the day, and we would walk through the entire match, and I would sit there and direct them and choreograph them. And we knew we would make the points of when people, you know, this is when this is going to happen. And when somebody does this, this is when you do this. And we would rehearse it for 2 or 3 hours. And then we'd come back later that night and we'd try to put on a show. And I say show in quotation marks because I only showed what I felt were the good parts of it in the film. And, you know, after that, I got into directing live theater, and then it kind of led to me doing film. And so doing a documentary on wrestling kind of really brought it full circle for me, you know, and so it felt appropriate to kind of, because I just found that footage over a year ago because I didn't think the footage still existed. I found it and was able to, you know, the entire event's on YouTube if you want to watch the abysmal entire show. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. I mean, that was a fun memory to have because we came out to music and yeah, I wasn't trained, but the thing I did, and I remember this, was that I was starting to watch how they fell all the time when they would fall, and I started watching stunt videos on how stuntmen took falls and fight scenes for film, and I kind of put two and two together. And so the first time I took a clothesline and tried to sell it, I figured out very quickly that tucking my chin and landing as flat as possible was the best way to land. And that's just kind of how I figured that out. And, but yeah, my mom and dad, I honestly, half of my wrestling matches, I don't think they knew happened. And I think I was just telling them at those events, I was just going to a youth group event. I didn't tell them I was wrestling or anything like that. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. It was kind of fun to be able to share that in the film.
So Medusa narrates your film, which I was quite surprised. I'm a big fan of Medusa. You got to be old school. So how easy was it to get Medusa on board?
Well, Medusa is, she's just fantastic. All around great gal. She contacted me in the middle of making the film. I want to say Leilani Kai somehow told her about me. Because I was doing some, I found out that there was some female wrestler from Springfield, and I was just reaching out to people that wrestled with her. Because I just wanted more info to see if I could do something on it possibly. And then Medusa, and I get this phone call, and I pick up the phone, and Medusa's like, hey, this is Medusa. And I was like, hi. You know, and basically we were, you know, talking about some video projects and stuff that we wanted to do. And it kind of has led to this great friendship. And I was needing a narrator, and I'm very much a believer in it doesn't hurt to ask somebody something. And the worst they can say is no. The best that can happen is they say yes. And I told her, I said, I need a narrator for this Flying Greek. Would you be interested in it? And without hesitation, she said, absolutely. And it kind of is a, it serves two purposes. Obviously, having a WWE Hall of Famer narrate your film is just that. That's just the icing on the cake. You know, it really helps bring some gravitas more to it than some people who may not know Manoli are going to look at it a little bit more now because she's involved. And the second part of it is, well, it's the Flying Greek. And even though Medusa stands for Made in the USA, it kind of plays into that Greek mythology. you know? And so, having her be a part of it was just really, a lot of fun, you know, and she would send me her narrations and then I would give her suggestions and then she would go back and, you know, went back and forth till we had the audio and her narration the way we wanted it. And so it just, having her be a part of it's great. And, you know, we've kind of become family. I mean, my daughter calls her Aunt Deb, you know.
Oh, awesome.
And, yeah. And she's just great. I have the utmost respect for that woman because I've seen of all the videos and stuff when we were putting stuff together for her, has one woman that I would not want to tick off in the ring. I tell you that much because there was a match that we saw when we were editing some videos for her, of her versus Aja Kong in a kickboxing match in All Japan over in Japan. And, I watched the match and I just ended up asking her, I'm like, did you guys really do the kickboxing for real? And the only thing was, no matter what happened, you had to end up at this point and go back into a storyline. And she goes, yeah, we beat the shit out of you. And there was a part where Aja does a backhand and hits her in the face. And I mean, her nose just gushing blood. And I was just like, oh my God. And, but she would get back up and she would just, and Aja Kong was a stout gal. And so here's Medusa getting the crap knocked out of her. She stands back up and goes back for it again. And it was just like, this woman's a badass. And and it made me realize how much more she could have done in the States if they would have treated her differently. Because over in Japan, hearing that crowd go wild when she walked out, you would think that Hulk Hogan was walking out at WrestleMania or something when she was over there. And just the different mindsets in the professional wrestling business between there and here, especially back then, was night and day. Cause I mean, when she came over, she was doing a lot more, valet work and things like that. And of course, when she was Alundra, you know, she was wrestling with Bull Nakano and having some really good matches in WWF back at the time. And, but when you see that versus what she was doing, it's kind of like, man, Vince, well, you really had something more that you could have done with her. And I'm glad that they did what they did with her. Don't get me wrong. But when you kind of see what her career was like over in Japan and how much she was kicking ass and taking names and doing stuff. And then, I mean, good Lord, I remember when she came out with Macho Man and Gorgeous George when Macho came back with his kind of revamped thing in WCW. And she was doing more then, but it always kind of felt like she was contained more than what she was over in Japan. And, I mean, they gave her a belt. She showed me the belt before she left. The people, like, they loved her so much, they made a belt that says women's, their people's champion over there. And I'm just like, that amount of respect over there is just crazy. And what she did, but you know, Deb was just, she's awesome.
So when you were looking for stuff, obviously Mike Pappas has a lot of stuff. Did you have stuff on him before or did you have to look for everything? And there's stuff you could not find that you wanted.
Yeah, I had nothing. Like I said, like I was thinking, how did I not hear about this guy in my own backyard, you know? And so all the stuff I got, like the pictures and all that was all him. His wife had kept it. He didn't care. You know, he just kind of was like, okay, that's cool. And he didn't really keep anything because he was just a job to him, but she kept a scrapbook. And so that's how I was able to get a lot of those pictures and things like that. So that was really helpful. But yeah, like I said earlier, the footage, couldn't find it. Everywhere we looked, we would go back to, I would contact these archives and they had just been bought out by WWE Network. And, so I reached out a couple of times, knew I probably wasn't going to get anything. And then, we had a lawyer reach out a couple of times and we never heard anything. So we just kind of got ghosted or just, you know, ignored. I was at least hoping for a solid no or a price and I didn't get either of those. You know, but I also am aware, too, though, that it's WWE, and I could have easily fallen through the cracks of their emails of, you know, who we were emailing. And, you know, but, you know, we made the best of it. I'm really glad with what we did and got creative, and we got those shots, like I called them the dream sequence shots, you know, with him wrestling in the black background, the one light and the smoke and stuff like that. So that was a lot of fun. And then getting him in the ring and him showing me the ropes, that kind of was a real cool thing to do as well, and replacement of that. But what's really funny, I kid you not, it was a month, 2 months after the premiere. I'm looking on Twitter, and I'm going through Twitter, and I follow all these wrestling things, and sometimes they'll have clips come up. And this clip pops up. It's just a clip. And it's Greg the Hammer Valentine showing how powerful his elbow drop was. That's what the whole test was, you know, those tests of power type things from back in the day. So he's in the corner and he's getting all, you know, ready to drop this elbow on a piece of wood that it's laid across two bricks. And I kind of paused it for a second and I went, no. And I rewound it and watched it again. Sure enough, Mike Pappas, the Flying Greek, is laying the board down for Greg the Hammer Valentine to drop the elbow on. And I was like, you've got to be effing kidding me. And, you know, it wasn't him wrestling, but it was more proof that I know that there's footage out there of him that exists. And somebody, you know, like I said, you know, he wasn't Greg the Hammer Valentine, so people don't know who he was. But I think that was also the big thing that attracted me to his story, was that everybody looks at that picture of Andre the Giant holding up that guy on his shoulder, and everybody's like, that's cool. Look how big Andre was. I'm like, oh yeah, he was, but who is this guy? You know, I want to know more about him. And that's kind of where that whole thing came from. But, and like I said, if a match pops up somewhere and I can put it on a DVD.
Now, when you're doing the interviews with the family, you're at their house. Now, yes. Were you the interview with his other daughter, Constantina? You're at the jewelry store. Now, my question is, was she uncomfortable being at home, or did you want to promote the jewelry store?
No. It was, she's from Tennessee. And so she was just in town for that weekend. And Manoli works all the time. And so she just happened to be at the store. And so, you know, it was just easy to set up at the store. And we just tried to get a different angle from Manoli. I mean, that's kind of. It was more about the simplicity of, oh, she's at the store. Okay, we'll just set up there to film.
Oh, she doesn't work there, because I always thought she worked there.
No, Constantina works, and she's in Tennessee. She's from the Appalachian Mountains of Tennessee, is what she said. You know, so we contacted her, and she came in for a weekend to film and then just kind of see family. And so she just happened to be there, and it was just this simplest way to set it up, because we'd already filmed there, so we just tried to do a different angle, so it was a different angle than what we did with Manoli, and to make it a little different. And yeah, that was pretty much it. Nothing crazy.
Okay, now obviously you're a wrestling fan, I get that. Where did you find all your wrestling experts, or are these just friends of yours that you said, yeah, you'll work perfectly?
For which part?
When you have the experts of wrestling discussing things. You have a lot of...
like Bill Apter and that?
Yes, exactly.
Bill Apter, we got a hold of him because of Manoli. Manoli just said, hey, contact him, And so I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. And he said, I will gladly do an interview. And so I put a call out on Facebook to see if there was anybody in his area that would be willing to do field producing for the film. And so we were able to get that. And of course, having Bill Apter, who's known and he's one of the top wrestling photographers and journalists ever, to be a part of that is just, you know, just gives them more gravitas to Manoli's story. And yeah, but it was because of Manoli that we were able to get a hold of Bill. And Bill was great. And, yeah, there'll be some more stuff I'm going to do with his, a couple of his unused things too, for the audio podcast.
Okay. Now, just some questions about Manoa. He still trains today. I think I understood that. At least he looks like he does.
Yeah, he is. After we wrestled, he called me the next day. And he said, how are you feeling? I said, oh, Manoli, I feel like crap. He goes, I feel great. I want to go for a jog. I'm like, of course you do. I've asked him about that. I don't think he does the training like he used to, but I do know that he tries to stay in good shape. He swims a lot and things like that. But I think it also comes down to his diet, because he's still just on the same diet he was from when he was in Rhodes, Greece. It's this Mediterranean diet that he follows. And that's just kind of how he does things, you know? And, I know he's got, like, I think he still has a little bit of gym and stuff, and he'll go out and do some things just to stay in shape, but he doesn't, you know, cross train or anything like he used to when he was wrestling, but he does stuff to keep in shape and everything like that.
Now, during the film, I felt you were doing interviews with yourself at times. How is it to do an interview with yourself?
Well, that was interesting because I didn't want to be in it, honestly. And when I brought Carbon Trace Productions on board to help me with the post-production, because I just needed that extra little help to finish it. And I wanted to do something special. And I had been talking with Carbon Trace for a while because one of my former teachers from college was helping run it. And it was tied into MSU, and they were using it to do stuff with students so students could get experience and have a project, which was something I always wanted when I was in college and never got. And so I contacted them, and as we were going through and talking about the documentary, my former teacher or professor, he looked at me and he goes, you need to interview. And I said, I don't want to. I said, I don't want to pull a Michael Moore. He goes, no. This is your Werner Herzog moment, because Werner Herzog kind of always is a part of his stories in a way. And the more and more we started editing it together, I was like, God, yeah, he's right. Because it was right. It was going to add an extra layer it was just going to add a little extra depth of having me, because I was part of the story. I really was. And, And as we did it, it kind of had an extra layer of that. And that's why I was able to add in the wrestling footage for me wrestling. And it just added like a little extra depth to it. Now, the interview, I wrote the questions and then I had my professor ask them, former professor.
Okay.
Yeah. I had him ask me. So it felt more natural instead of me like trying to rehearse it. And it was Andy Klein and Shannon was behind camera and helping us do that. And I appreciate Carbon Trace. They are a nonprofit documentary company, and I highly suggest people check Carbon Trace Productions out. They are great.
Okay. Another question about Manoli. I wrote down after watching, he still believes he's wrestling in business with the big boys. Mm-hmm. Is he like that every day? Like it never changes.
He never changes. He is always ready. He is always, like he said, in wrestling, he was the little guy going against the giants, the big people, and he was always fighting for that. And it's the same thing in the jewelry business. He was, you know, his own independent thing, Manoli's Jewelers. But, you know, he's going against Hallsberg Jewelers and the big boys. And so he has to put in the extra, you know, fight to get people's attention from those people. And it's the same attitude he had in wrestling, you know, and I think that's what's really great about him is that, you know, the same attitude he had when he would wrestle against Harley Race or with Andre is the same attitude he has in business. And I think that's what makes him successful and unique.
Now you do sneak an after credit scene in your film that, why?
It just felt like there were so many great moments with him and I in that ring that I wanted to show him at the end, like just for fun. If people stayed and watched to the end credits of him, just him and I just laughing, because I felt that that was just kind of a cool way to, if I had an end credit scene, it just, you know, it felt right, you know, to show that he was, there was just so much that he and I did in that ring with him clotheslining me and him crawling between my legs and underneath me and just showing me the ropes. And then at the end, he's sitting there just ready to go. Like he's back in the day. And it was just, you know, it just, that little scene, just, it just felt right to have it there.
Okay. That is it. We just have fun questions left now.
Okay. Let's do it.
I think we've covered your film fairly well. I think I've hit on a lot of stuff. I ask everybody the first question's always the same. If you come back again, it will be different. Your favorite film?
Favorite film? Dr. Zhivago.
Number two, your favorite wrestler?
That's hard.
I know it will be.
My favorite wrestler, Cactus Jack.
So, yeah, just Cactus Jack. We're not including anything else. No Mankind, no nothing, just Jack.
I love that character.
Fair enough. Number three, if you were going to be put into a wrestling hold, what hold would you want to be put into?
Oh, God. There's so many by so many people that would be interesting. We talking submission holds or finishing moves?
Whatever makes you happy. I'll give you both.
Oh, of course, getting a Stone Cold Stunner from Stone Cold Steve Austin is always a kind of would always be a highlight. And you know, I don't know, the Anaconda Vice that CM Punk does. I love CM Punk.
So I think everybody does. WWE wasted him, just wasted that whole thing. But that's another whole show we could do.
Yeah, it's another show.
Tell everybody where they can find your stuff.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Jason Brazier, and then on Instagram it's at Jason Brazier Film, and flintlocksyndicate.com is my website. I'm on Facebook as well. You can look up Jason Brazier Film there, and the Flying Greek documentary on there. We're going to be setting up some more screenings soon, so we'll be putting up a lot more information on our social media and when those are going to happen.
Thanks for your time and have a great day.
Hey, you too. Thanks for having me.